Hello, everyone, and welcome to the fourth edition of Swing Politics. I am your host, Mitch Saunders, and I'm just going to make sure our system is working, and I'll be right on. Thanks so much. Hello, everyone. How's it going on this very early morning, February 8th? It's a bright 3:05, and to all the listeners out there, especially Jake, thank you so much for listening in. It's very much appreciated from people like me. So this is Mitch Saunders, and you're listening to 91.5 WMFO, Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio. And in this very special edition of Swing Politics, we're going to be talking about the last election of the 2022 cycle, talking about the postmortem, which we sort of spoke about last time a few weeks ago, and go into where the nation's going, where the Republican Party is going, how the Democrats plan to move forward with this, the 2023 elections that start up now, got to get gearing up for them, and then focusing on the presidential election, because the Iowa caucuses are only 14 months away. I believe that's right. Something about them, maybe 13 months at this point. Because politics never ends. So let's get right into it and discuss the election in Georgia, the Senate runoff between Reverend Raphael Warnock, the incumbent senator who won in 2020 in the runoff against Kelly Loeffler by about 2 points, versus former running back of University of Georgia, Herschel Walker. Other than that, I don't know much more about him. But how did Warnock win? The ultimate result of the election was 51.4 to 48.6, which is not a blowout victory, but for a Georgia Democrat, I believe it's the largest victory in the past 28 years, I believe, going back to Carter. Clinton in 1992. So 30 years, I suppose. And sort of what was the coalition made up of that Warnock won with? And I think it's it was sort of a few things. The first is getting the black belt on his side. There's a sort of historically rural location of African-American voters, sort of harkening back to even the days of slavery, where the most fertile land in Georgia was where plantation owners settled, and that's where they would have their slaves. And once emancipation took place, a lot of those freed men and freed families stayed there, and because they didn't have the capital, they didn't have the money, the opportunities to move up north. So in doing so, there's a sort of a Democratic bastion today of support in this southern sort of rural section of Georgia, reaching from Savannah to around Macon. And there are some other smaller cities, like Athens. These are all small little pockets of Democratic support, largely rural, some small cities. And a lot of this was, a lot of Warnock support came from this, in terms of he would not have won the election without it. And I think that it's important to note that he flipped two of the Black Belt counties from the November election against Walker. Those were Washington and Baldwin counties that originally had voted for Walker in November, but Warnock flipped it. And in addition, he hit his marks in the Atlanta metro region, which, of course, everyone knows the only reason why Georgia became a competitive state in the first place was because of the booming economy of Atlanta that kind of took off, especially over the past 15 years or so. Because it's not just Atlanta now. It's not Atlanta where Democrats are getting votes. It's the Atlanta metro. And although early on in the election it seemed as though Walker was hitting the numbers that he needed to in the rural areas, he was about matching his November numbers, which arguably isn't enough, because in November Warnock won by about 0.9 over Walker, and it was 49.4 to 48.5. So if Walker was matching his numbers in the rural areas, it wouldn't have been enough for him to win, for him to get over 50%. And Walker was matching his support in those rural counties, but he was also overperforming them a little bit, a hair, maybe a point here, a point there. So that was definitely something to sort of... was a little bit shocking to see. We thought that Walker wouldn't be able to have that kind of support, but the rural areas did turn out for him, but he got absolutely crushed in the suburban and urban areas, which is where Warnock was able to win. So, especially when we're looking at the Atlanta Metro, it's important to look at the most recent counties that have sort of trended towards the Democrats beyond Fulton and DeKalb and, there's one more that I'm missing. Let me see if I can pull it up here. Fulton, DeKalb, and Clayton County. Those three kind of make up the core of the Atlanta, the city itself. But if you're kind of looking into Atlanta Extended, Cobb County, Gwinnett County, Newton County, Henry County, these are areas that are outside of the city limits, but they've become more Democratic as the city has sort of sprawled, as Democrats have gained with suburban voters, and suburban voters have become more of their coalition, as well as the sort of college education that correlates with suburban areas and the close to urban areas as well. So... these counties, the four that I mentioned before, were very closely, but were won by Romney in 2012. But in yesterday's election, or it's actually 2 days now, Warnock won these counties on average by about 60%, 61% he was getting in these counties. These are very populous counties that are necessary to win the state. They've got Gwinnett has 265,000 voters that just voted, another 300,000 in Cobb, another 100,000 in Henry, 40,000 in Newton. These are absolutely critical for the Democrats to get because they don't have the rural support that they would need to. And that's sort of the story of every Democratic Party. And although Democrats do have the support of the Black Belt, it's not enough without those suburban numbers. It's a combination of a lot of different sort of alignments that they need to get the wins. So essentially what at least I would posit as the reason why Warnock especially did well was because of his ability to persuade, especially white voters, especially suburban voters. The reason why I argue that is because Democrats in 2022 did very well at persuading, especially white working class voters, to vote for them. They made an argument that worked because Republicans won the generic ballot. They won the generic ballot by around 2. So if just solely based on partisanship, if they were to vote necessarily based on their party alignment, or if they felt that they voted for Trump twice, but they still voted for Democratic candidates, that is something that is... that did not happen as much in 2022, especially in the Rust Belt, and I think in the South as well. And that's also attributed to the poor candidate quality of the Republicans and of the Republican Party, the contenders that they put up. So persuasion, I think, was definitely a part of it. And voter turnout was across the state fairly uniform, more or less, especially in the Atlanta metro region and the northern sort of populous, more rural. They tend to be more ex-urban counties, but they're more rural than ex-urban. That's where the Republican support is. The combination of those two kind of canceled themselves out in terms of a drop in turnout, because runoffs always have a drop in turnout. There's no national implications, especially for this election, because the Democrats already had won the Senate. The turnout was about 10% less than it was in November, and that was both in the northern Republican strongholds as well as in the Atlanta metro. So those two kind of canceled themselves out. Where Democrats made up for it is that, and you could argue that it was a little bit even, but the turnout in southern rural counties well below the Atlanta metro region, their turnout was actually less of a decrease. So it was around a 7 or 8% average turnout decrease, which is much better, and especially in the rural counties, is what Democrats needed to do. And it was probably some of the counties that had lower turnout, they were able to either persuade certain voters to, or certain voters also didn't possibly know to go to the polls for this election, or they were able to get, Warnock's team was able to do a get out the vote, especially for rural black voters. Interestingly enough, funny, there is one county in Georgia that is Walker's hometown. It's Johnson County, and Johnson County was the only county that had an increase in turnout from November to December. It was an 100.5% turnout of their November turnout, 101.5, something like that. And ultimately, Warnock gained. That county swung to the left, swung towards him, which is pretty funny that even Walker's home county, a very rural county, did not want him there. So when we're looking at, again, the suburban numbers compared to just 2 years ago, I'll take an example of something like Gwinnett County, which is sort of in the northeast corridor, northeast section of the Atlanta metro region. Warnock got 62% of the vote, 62-38, last night, 2 nights ago. In 2021, he had 60%, closer to 61%. In Cobb County, he got 60%. In 2021, when he was running against Kelly Loeffler, got 57%. Newton County, he was at 58% in 2021. In 2022, he's at 59%. And in Henry County, he's at 66%, whereas he was at 63% in 2021. These are small. These seem like they're 1%, 2%, but in a densely populated county, a county that has a lot of votes at least, every vote matters in a state where the election was decided by 100,000 votes. So I think it's also good to talk about candidate quality, because that was the conversation around the Republicans in 2022. For the first time since 1934, Democrats did not lose a single incumbent Democratic senator, which is a feat for the Democratic Party. Rarely does that happen. It's the fifth best performing midterm for an incumbent party since FDR, in the last 100 years, even longer than FDR. So it's definitely a feather in the cap for the Democrats, but also it's for sure a fluke in some ways. I mean, did Democrats make really good cases for persuasion? Yes, but that was only the reason why, was because their Republican counterparts were so off the rails. And Herschel Walker is a phenomenal example of that. Talking about how he is pro-life, how he is, you know, anti-abortion, and he is, you know, Bible-thumping and all the like, when he is, you know, bankrolling Planned Parenthood. And he's just going out and saying whatever he wants to, whatever he can. You know, there's just numerous statements of him that he's just made just on the stump. And it's nothing compared to, you know, the poise of Warnock, who is, you know, staying strong on messaging. He listens to, you know, what his advisors say. He has a strong voting record. The state is becoming more and more purple, and they're sort of looking for that stability. But, you know, something along the lines of the fact that Herschel Walker was such a bad candidate, out of all the slate of bad candidates the Republicans put up this past year, you could argue that he is the worst. So a lot of people were saying that, you know, he didn't lose by enough, that it was only 2.8%, which is kind of shocking, and that it was still forced to a runoff where Warnock isn't actually as strong as he is sort of, made up to be, because he didn't even get 50%. He only beat him by a little bit, and even in the runoff, it wasn't that close. 3% is not a blowout victory when you're running against, you know, an election denier, an insane person who is completely against, you know, the morals of both the Republican and the Democratic Party. So I think this is not, I think this isn't a claim that isn't right because of the state of Georgia itself. Southern politics, especially in the Southeast, the Deep South, is very much a static sort of political system compared to a state like, even in the Southwest, like Arizona. These are people that have sort of had political affiliations for a long time, and that they are you know, they finally completely switched over to Republican, and they have for the past, you know, 15 years or so. But there's a staticness in the in the state of Georgia, in the rural areas, that sort of makes the political alignment of the state very kerneled. And I think that's especially the case when looking at Mississippi. The political and the political realignment along the lines of race is astounding. You have 98% of whites in Mississippi that are voting for Republicans, which is, and you have 98% of African American voters that vote for Democrats in Mississippi. Now, this isn't the case in Georgia, because of the Atlanta metro section. Because if you don't have that Atlanta metro, if you don't have Atlanta and Gwinnett and Cobb, you don't have that sort of growing area where young people are drawn and where there's a booming economy, you don't get that sort of situation. You don't have, because there are a lot of white, suburban, college-educated voters that are voting for Democrats, whereas that's, there's no hub like that in Alabama. There's no hub like that in Mississippi. So I think that the fact that Warnock won by, it was just under 100,000 votes, is extremely impressive in its own right. It was out of around 3.5 million that he won 100,000 votes. 3% is an enormous victory for a Democrat in a state that literally just turned blue. And it was happening for a while, and Georgia's a sort of a slow-moving train, will continue to get more blue over the next, you know, few elections. We don't know how long, you know, it would last or what realignment looks like, but given current trends, it's slated to become more and more Democratic over time. And if you're comparing it to a state like Arizona, where they elected Mark Kelly by 6%, or if you're, you know, looking at Michigan, where Michigan has swung from to Trump by, you know, 0.3 and then voted for Gretchen Whitmer by 10, voted for Biden by 3, like, that's a much more elastic state. There's a lot of persuasion and there's a lot less of a kernelization of politics, especially by white Americans in the Rust Belt and in the West and the Northeast and the Southeast, Southwest, in a different way than there is in the Deep South. And so I think that Warnock's victory was a result of the sort of weird political alignment of having the New Age Democrats with the Atlanta Metro and the sort of old Democrats in the Black Belt sort of coming together to lift him up. And I think that that's something that you'll continue to see in Democratic candidates over time. But Democrats, I think, will continue to leech support, which has been clear in the last few elections. They will continue to leech their rural Black Belt support as the elections go on. So that's something that they'll have to, you know, make a very concerted effort to get out the vote in those rural areas, because rural Black voters are especially potent because there's not a sort of concerted effort in terms of their voter suppression. It's much harder to suppress rural voters. There are no lines when they go to their polling stations compared to where in Fulton County lines were, you know, upwards of an hour. And in Fulton County, it's majority minority. It's majority, I believe it's majority Black. I don't know if that's exactly right, but that's the goal. The goal is to sort of suppress where all the population centers are, because that's where Democrats are. But they can't do that to rural areas, so that's why having rural support is extremely important, even if it's small, is important for the Democratic Party. So I think that we've hit on the important stuff for the Georgia election. I applaud Senator Warnock, who will be in that position until at least January of 2029. But let's go on to sort of say that now the Democrats have a 51-49 majority in the Senate. One moment, please. Sorry about that. So Democrats now have a 51-49 majority in the Senate. What does that mean? What is the importance of that? They already have the majority going into this. And speaking of, if the majority was on the line and Republicans felt more motivated to come out for Herschel Walker because they gave the Republicans a majority, I think Walker, this would have been a very close race, and I think Walker would have been favored. But regardless, that wasn't the case because Cortez Masto, Fetterman, Mark Kelly, they all did their job. Haasen, too. Even though she was running against a, you know, not-so-good candidate herself. But let's get back on track. What does this mean for Democrats in the Senate? And I think the biggest takeaway from this is that there's an easier time getting Senate nominees discharged from committee and getting bills discharged from committee. The most important thing is that because Republicans hold the House now, Democrats will not be able to pass any of the bills that they want to. Reconciliation bills will be, you know, compromise bills that the two houses will have to come together on. So the Senate's going to be, you know, just a judiciary confirming machine. When there is a power sharing agreement in a 50-50 Senate, it allows the Republicans to hold up nominees at a greater rate. And now that Democrats don't have to sort of abide by those rules because they don't have to share the power anymore, they have the outright majority, confirmations of federal judgeships, circuit judgeships, state-level judgeships can be confirmed. And that's a big deal. It's very important to shape the court. There was a confirmation, I believe, just last night, though it's not with the new Congress yet, because the new Congress will be sworn in January. But in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, there was a Bush judge that was that took, you know, senior position, and she was being replaced by a Biden nominee. So it's going to be things like that that will shape the Biden administration, shape their legacy as can they do judges like McConnell did them. They have all 4 years, same as McConnell did, same with for Trump. They hold the Senate for all 4 years. Can they do it? And so that's going to be their job. There's also a two-vote buffer. There's a two-vote buffer with two Democrats. If two Democrats are absent from the Senate, 49-49, Vice President Harris can still break the tie. Harris also benefits from this because she can have a public agenda now. When Congress is in session, she doesn't have to be there to break every 50-50 tie. She can now, you know, she could be more public, I suppose, which is something that is definitely a benefit to her. I also think something that is a benefit is to Manchin. Manchin can kind of, going into 2024, he is likely to be running for re-election, and we'll get into the 2024 Senate map soon, but Manchin may have benefited from this, as I was talking to my brother about a little bit, in that he can go against the party and vote with the Republicans on a lot of things, while his party will not be penalized because Harris can cast the tie-breaking vote. So Manchin might be able to get more political coverage going into 2024, saying, hey, look, I didn't support, you know, this. I tried to get, permit leasing, which is something that I don't know very much about, but something that he's pushing a lot for. It gives him coverage politically, and the Democrats are fine with that. If Schumer's whipping votes and he's got 50 and Manchin says, I don't think I should support this, my constituents don't like it, then he's good. And Manchin has been, you know, pretty good in line with the Democratic Party. I think he votes with Biden, you know, must be like, you know, 80% of the time, 85% of the time, maybe more. So and especially on the important things. So I think that's definitely a boon for him. And then also, Democrats have subpoena power in committees. In the power sharing agreement, neither party had the power to subpoena any individual. And now Democrats have the sole power to do so, which is great. Good for them. Good for us all, actually. And so, why is this seat so important beyond that? I think when we're looking at every, you know, political pundit, every person looking at the election map since the 2018 midterms has sort of seen the dread in the eyes of the Democratic Party going into the 2024 Senate elections. Now, Democrats are institutionally disadvantaged in the Senate by about 6 to 7 points. It's a very Republican-leaning institution. If you take states that Biden won and give them both senators, I think you have exactly 50. But Democrats' coalition is made up of a senator from Ohio, Sherrod Brown, a senator from Montana, John Tester, and of course Joe Manchin from West Virginia, as well as made up of Tammy Baldwin from Wisconsin, which is barely a Biden state. You have Kyrsten Sinema, who is up In 2024, you have Jackie Rosen from Nevada. Nevada's been rightward trending marginally. All six of those that I just mentioned are up in 2024. And in a presidential year, you have very, very little crossover between the people that vote for the president and vote for the Senate and House, and as well as their governor races. It has been very much documented over the past 20 years, 30 years, I think, even more, that ticket splitting has continually decreased as the political parties have gotten more polarized. So if you're looking at John Tester, who is in a Trump plus 16 state and won by about 3.5 points in 2018, which was a Democrat plus 8.5 year, you're kind of staring down the barrel of a gun. Now, John Tester has a long relationship with the state. He was elected in 2006, ousting Senator Conrad, I believe. And he was reelected in 2012 with flying colors. In 2018, realignment caught up to him, but he still was able to outrun it because he's a good incumbent and because it was a very, very, very good year for Democrats. In 2024, when it's a Democrat and a Republican on the ticket, at the top of the ticket, people are going to turn out and vote for them, and maybe there will be some ticket splitting as you go down the ballot. But Tester's basically dead on arrival, and I think the same can be said for Manchin and Sherrod Brown in Ohio. The 2024 Senate map is brutal for Democrats, and that's why they wanted to win, especially Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. They were so close to winning Wisconsin, which would have made their path a lot easier to win the Senate. The other problem with the 2024 Senate map, beyond Nevada, Arizona, Montana, West Virginia, Wisconsin, Ohio, is the fact that there are no openings for Democrats to make gains. The two closest seats for them to pick up are Florida and Texas. Florida just voted for a Republican governor by 20 and a Republican senator by 16. And this incumbent is much weaker than the both of those. Rick Scott is, not a popular Republican. He, defrauded Medicare. I mean, you can't get much worse than that. But that being said, when it's 2024 and, either Ron DeSantis or Donald Trump are on that ticket, both of whom Florida loves, there's really no opening to take down Rick Scott, because Trump's going to win the state by at least 6 or 7, and DeSantis will win it by more. There's no way you can ticket split 7 points in this highly polarized era in a presidential year. You just can't do it. So the next best option for Democrats is a state that's trending towards them is Texas, but it's doing it slowly. And there's an incumbent, it's Ted Cruz, who is also not liked. And I think that Texas is sort of the biggest opening for Democrats to take down, because Cruz is just awful. And the state has trended. The last time he ran against Beto O'Rourke, Beto before he was nationalized, made statements that sort of made him unpalatable to the electorate in Texas. He only won the election by 2.8%, and that was 6 years ago. And Texas has become more blue since then. So if there's any opening, it's that. And I think that Biden lost the state by about 5.5 2 years ago. So I think that is the Democratic opening. If you have a really good candidate and Cruz continues to be his insane self, I think it would be really close. But that's the best chance for a Democrat to actually pick up that seat. However, you're staring at Democrats losing 3 seats in the Senate in 2024. And that puts you at 52-48 for the Republicans. Because John Tester of Montana, Sherrod Brown of Ohio, and Joe Manchin of West Virginia will not win. And I think, a lot of people say, look at Sherrod Brown's recent elections. He was able to win by 6%, and, he has crossover support, and, all these things. When, if you're looking at Ohio, Ohio has just lurched to the right. They don't want Democrats in that state at all. Tim Ryan put up the best performance by a Democrat probably that you'll see in the next 20 years in Ohio, and he still lost by 6.5. He outran Biden by 1.5 points. So Sherrod Brown's an incumbent. Yes, he's been there a long time, but Tim Ryan was a representative of the Youngstown sort of area. This was a very white working class Rust Belt area that was very pro-union, very supportive of Democrats and what they had done traditionally for the workers. And they continue to do, but the disillusionment and the misinformation from, Fox News and Republican candidates has sort of left the party in shambles there. And Ryan won this district in 2016 by about 40 points. And in 2020, he won it by 8. So even Ryan, who's been there for, he's 10 term or, 5, 6, 7 term incumbent, really liked there, overperformed, but it didn't matter. So even Sherrod Brown is an incumbent, and he'll make it a close race. Sure, maybe not necessarily a close race, but he'll make it a race. Money will definitely be spent in there. But I don't see, one, the Republicans making a lot of the same mistakes that they did this time. Well, that's actually not true. I think the Republicans will end up putting up really, really bad candidates in 2024 because the establishment doesn't own the party. It seems as though, as of right now, Trump kind of does. And though his grip is kind of weakening, it's Trump and the voters. But if the establishment makes a concerted effort around one candidate and Trump has endorsed another one, maybe there's a different story. And do Democrats want that? Do Democrats want to sort of keep relying on Republicans to put up really bad candidates for their candidates to win? Unfortunately, especially in the Senate, it seems like the only way for them to keep their majority. So that's going to be the next sort of part of the conversation is going into 2024. But if you talk about the Republicans and their performance in 2022, Republicans gained 9 seats in the House. That's pretty much nothing for a midterm year. Democrats gained a seat in the Senate. They flipped one, which is shocking. They gained 3 governorships and they lost 1. And they gained 5 legislatures: the Michigan Senate, Michigan House, Pennsylvania House, Minnesota Senate, and Alaska Senate, all while keeping control of, I believe, all of their chambers. Otherwise, Republicans in legislatures, where they are inherently benefited because of the 2010 re-election that 2010 redistricting that put them in a very strong position for the 2020 redistricting. They only gained. They're favored because of that. They only gained 22 seats in legislatures across the nation, across all 50 states. To give you some context, there are, I believe there are a couple thousand state House districts and state Senate districts, and Republicans gained over 100 in the Obama years. Sorry, punchline. Gained over 1,000. So if you're comparing just in 8 years, especially 2010 and 2014, across 4 elections, the Republicans gained over 1,000 state legislatorial seats, whereas Republicans only gained 22 in this seat. It's an 22 seats in this election. It's an abysmal performance for the Republicans. It really is. They should be embarrassed, and the reason why is largely because of their candidate quality. And if you look at these states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Minnesota, there are states where poor candidates were put up for election, and they were swiftly rejected, and that had down-ballot election results. And it was persuasion that allowed them to do that. So, where is the nation going in partisanship? Where do we think that, sort of, looking at 2024, another presidential year, where does this all stand? I think you're going to be looking at only a handful of swing states. But I think it's important to, in terms of the presidential year, but I think it's important to start and talk about the Republican Party as we were doing, is that what do we think is going on with this Trump-DeSantis situation? Before the 2022 elections, DeSantis really was very much not in favor of sort of, I think, jumping in the ring. I think it was something he didn't want to step on Trump's toes. Trump had sort of one more term to run unless, de-democratization, which is always a possibility. But DeSantis, DeSantis didn't want to step on his toes. DeSantis didn't want to make an enemy, especially someone that is so powerful within the Republican Party. That was the same thinking before the 2022 midterms. Trump was sort of a kingmaker. He was a god within the Republican Party, and still is, to be completely honest. But he had more clout going into the 2022 midterms. He had gotten Dr. Oz across the line. He got Blake Masters across the line. He got all of his chosen candidates across the line. Turns out they all lost, or if not all of them, the ones that were in competitive races lost. He has clearly an extremely poor track record in 2022 with the candidates that he put up in House districts. 35 most competitive, I believe, like six of them won, maybe even less. I think it was maybe two. Out of all of his, out of all the competitive Senate races, he endorsed one, J.D. Vance, and he won because of the partisanship of the state, not because of Trump. And he even underperformed. So I think that Republican establishment, excuse me, one second. Republican establishment is sort of seeing this, and I think DeSantis is licking his chops. Republicans in the Senate, Republicans in the House are very much looking forward past Trump. I don't think that they see a future with him because he is taking the party, and he's taking the party in a direction where it's unsustainable. Because Democrats are putting up good candidates, they're being very smart with their fundraising, with their candidate quality, with their get out the vote, with their canvassing, their organization, their campaign staffs, and it's paying off. Is it paying off in close margins? Yes, but it doesn't matter. You've won this. If you win the seat, you win the seat. But Republicans are putting up really bad candidates, and because of that, because they're putting up such bad candidates, they're costing Republicans majority status in the Senate and quite possibly the House in the future. So do we think that DeSantis is sort of going to be the one to beat in 2024? Do we think that it's going to be a Trump-DeSantis showdown? Do we think DeSantis is going to sort of step back and say it's Trump's? I think at the rate we're going, and who's going to win the nomination for the first, you know, in the first place? If I were to look at this right now and say, let's fast forward 2024, I couldn't tell you. But if it were today, and if the Iowa caucuses were held today, I still think Trump would probably win them. But if I'm looking forward at 2024, I would say DeSantis is in the driver's seat. In some way, I think they've both got a hand on the wheel. They definitely both have a hand on the wheel. But DeSantis has sort of been the rising star of the Republican Party. If he doesn't go now, he might lose his chance. He's only in the governorship in Florida until 2026. Sure, he could run for Senate. But what I think is the biggest question is, if DeSantis does win the primary, it's going to be drawn out. It's going to be bloody, and Trump is going to get a significant portion of the voters. And he will not concede, and he will not tell his supporters to go for Ron DeSantis. He despises Ron DeSantis because DeSantis takes away from his limelight. Trump was the guy. There was no other person. Everyone had fallen in line behind him. He proved you don't need to be a big tent party to win. He carried House members across the line in 2020, and I think people underestimate his strength. He's a bad candidate, but somehow he's also a good candidate. Because he's faux populist, and faux populist hits very well amongst the Fox News inundated populace. But I think if we were to look at sort of who is better for the party long term, it's DeSantis. Because Trump is just overtly trying to kill democracy, whereas DeSantis would just do it behind closed doors, because that's McConnell's goal. And I also think that DeSantis is someone that is going to prove to throw some punches at Trump. But the thing is, if he wants to hit the king, he's got to kill the king. So if DeSantis dethrones Trump in 2024, the best case scenario for Democrats is Trump runs third party, gets on the ballot. Trump puts up a stink. A drawn-out, bloody primary is the best thing for the Democrats. But that also leaves open the question that I think personally, if Trump is the nominee, Biden should be the nominee. But if DeSantis is the nominee, I don't want Biden to be the nominee. Biden could not win against DeSantis. But at the same time, incumbents win 2 out of every 3 elections. And if Trump is putting up a stink, and even if that stink is 2% of the electorate in those swing states, that's enough for Biden to win. So I think the hesitance against Biden right now, I think, is premature. We don't know what's going to happen. And I think that there is not anything that sort of has to be done for Biden, especially within the next few months. I don't think there's... I don't know. There are a lot of really, really good Democratic candidates out there. There's Roy Cooper in North Carolina, who's clearly an electoral juggernaut in the state. Gretchen Whitmer, Warnock, Mark Kelly. You have a lot of very, very good Democratic candidates that are in the wheelhouse. But if you have one that works, and Biden proved himself in this, I don't think this was Biden's doing. I think that. This was a lot of, you know, Democrats, and I think that Biden can be attributed to help this win, but it was also Republicans that shot themselves in both feet and the face and their gut. Like, they did everything they could to possibly lose this election. So I think if it's Trump v. DeSantis, I think Democrats are going to be licking their chops. I don't know what McConnell thinks about this. I mean, obviously, McConnell is certainly behind DeSantis, but he is not going to... He's going to keep his lips sealed. And McConnell, realistically, is likely to retire in 2026. If I were a betting man, McConnell's gone by 2026. So he has his position for the while, but I think he's going to want Trump. He doesn't want Trump near that presidency anymore. He hates what he has done for what it has done for his party, and that he's going to be in minority status for another 2 years. And what will happen in the House? I think this is an immediate question. Is McCarthy seems like he's not going to get the speakership, and that getting the speakership is going to be a little bit of a jockeying thing here. I don't think that there's no way that, you know, a Democrat or a moderate Republican will get the nomination, unless Democrats were to organize with, you know, people like Brian Fitzpatrick and. Excuse me. I don't know who else. But McCarthy has, I believe, 5 no votes against him, and he has 222 in the House. So that's 217. The math isn't there yet. Maybe he'll convince people, and I think they'll end up getting people in line. But it'd be shocking if McCarthy spent all this time in the minority. As a young gun coming up, he's going to be the rising up-and-comer, and he doesn't get the speakership. Speaker could be anyone, which is a really weird thing, is that any person in the United States, any political figure, any singular person could be speaker. Technically, the Republicans could put Trump as speaker. Obviously, they wouldn't. But Tammy Duckworth has gotten a few votes from Democratic House representatives in previous years when they didn't hold the majority. So, yeah. That's kind of... little bit of a rundown of what's going on in terms of 2024, looking at the speakership, looking at the Georgia runoff. But before 2024 is 2023. And, you know, obviously me, the election junkie, that's the only thing I want to look at is when's the next election. And by the way, there is a special election, I believe, in January for a state Senate district in Virginia. The state Senate is currently controlled by Democrats. 21 to 18, because there's a Republican vacancy. But let's go through the 2023 election. So, as I mentioned, I can start with Virginia. So these are, in November of 2023, there will be 3 governorships. The Virginia House of Delegates will be up, and the Virginia Senate will be up. So the most contentious of these, obviously the Louisiana governorship and the Mississippi governorship are not slated to be competitive. Democrats currently hold the Louisiana governorship with John Bel Edwards, but that was kind of a good candidate, a fluke scenario. It's unlikely that they'll elect a Democrat come 2023. and Mississippi will just likely reelect their governor, Tate Reeves. Kentucky, on the other hand, seems to be a little bit of a toss-up. You have Andy Beshear, who is the son of a former governor, current governor. I believe he was the attorney general at one point. He has spent a lot. He has a lot of experience in the state. He's well liked in the state. He has really high approval ratings. He's working with a Republican legislature and obviously is vetoing very many bills by them. But he understands the partisanship of his state. He is he was elected in 2019, and he has a shot at winning. I personally think that partisanship is so important that I don't know if he could stay, especially if they have a good Republican candidate. But that's going to be a close election to watch. And I think what's more important beyond... we should continue with the November election. So in November, the Virginia House of Delegates and the Virginia Senate will both be up for election. Now, if you can recall, in 2021, Republicans flipped the governorship in Virginia and they flipped the House of Delegates, which was a shock. A little bit of a crazy Republican overperformance. People did not anticipate it. I mean, it's a Biden plus 10 state, and Republicans flipped the governorship by 2. So, Democrats will have a chance of taking back the state house, and Republicans will have a chance of taking the state senate. If Republicans flip the state senate, that they will hold a trifecta in Virginia, which would be crazy. And if Democrats flip both, then they'll have just 2 chambers over the governor. But they obviously will not have, anywhere near a veto-proof majority. So those are going to be interesting in November. But sooner than that is, obviously, within that is also the January special election for the Virginia Senate. But in April, there will be an election for Wisconsin State Supreme Court. And the reason why this is important is because the court ideologically is made up 4-3 conservatives to liberals. In the most recent redistricting decision for Wisconsin, the rulings were that the gerrymandered maps that were put in place in 2010 should not be changed, with map of least change based on solely population but nothing else. Now, Wisconsin is basically not a democracy. The Republicans in the state legislature and governorship, when they controlled it from 2010 to 2018, gerrymandered their lines so that they would almost always have really high majorities or even super majorities to override the governor whenever they need to. They gutted the Republicans upon losing the governorship, gutted the governorship of its power. They gutted the state treasurer of its power, state secretary of state of its power, because those are statewide elected officials, and Republicans don't like voters to be heard, especially in Wisconsin. So there is a very, very important election that's coming up statewide in 2023 for this. And the reason why it's so important is because this is a conservative seat, and if Democrats flip the seat, they'll be able to issue a ruling that would be able to ungerrymander the congressional and legislative maps for Wisconsin, which would open up democracy again in the state. Democrats haven't controlled the chamber since either state house or state senate since 2008, even while winning the popular vote on numerous occasions between 2008 and 2022. So that's the most important election, arguably more important than the governorships or the Virginia. I would say the Virginia races are pretty important because it would hand Republicans a trifecta in the state to pass whatever bills they would want, they would need to. But yeah, it's that, the election cycle never ends and the election season never ends, and that this Wisconsin state Supreme Court race is going to be crucial. And from what I understand, there is a Republican candidate that Trump is considering endorsing who is off the rails. So we're going to see. And it's technically a nonpartisan race, but it has sort of somewhat partisan affiliations. Yeah. So I guess I'm going to close out here soon enough with, first off, a PSA. Give me one second. Don't drink and drive. If you are under the influence of anything, never even think about getting behind the wheel of a car and driving. People die that way. A public service message from WMFO in Medford Tufts Educational Radio. So I think after this election, Democrats are very happy, very content. They can pass a lot of new laws in state legislatures that they now hold trifectas in. They have a Senate majority, of course, and it's going to be tough to not have the House sort of in their favor, but they can get things done. In terms of what's being done in the lame duck session, there, as was reported recently, the Senate passed the Respect for Marriage Act, which protects same-sex marriage in the wake of the Supreme Court gutting all of its precedent, as much as Chief Justice Roberts loves stare decisis. They love, you know, the decisions of the court, and that they are very important. They don't care about precedents at all when they hold the power. So that was a very big win. And there is an NDAA, which is like an omnibus sort of military funding, where Republicans and Democrats have come together. They've both gotten wins. I believe McCarthy got rid of the COVID vaccine mandate, which is such an odd thing to rail against and doesn't give you any political points with anyone whatsoever, especially when it's in a nonsense bill that is, like, you know, completely behind the scenes. And McCarthy is just an awful, like, campaigner. He's just so unappealing to, like, people. But there's, I believe, one other bill. And then also the funding to fund the government, because there's a deadline in, I believe, towards the end of December to fund the government. And there's an omnibus bill in which I believe Senator Collins had just discussed that the Electoral Counts Act would be included, which strengthens the ability for the state, for the vote counts for presidential, for any, I believe, for presidential or federal elections to not be impeded by state legislatures and their partisan tomfoolery like they tried to do in Arizona or Georgia, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, the like, things like that, that Republicans were, you know, supporting. So, yeah, I think that's it for this edition of Swing Politics. This will probably be the last one for the semester, but I will be back next semester, hopefully with a better time that isn't 3 to 4 a.m., because this is brutal. As much as I love it, I really, really do. Very, very fun to sort of voice my opinions and talk about political stuff that I'm sort of, I only talk to my family about, or maybe my super interested friends. But I hope you enjoyed listening, and you know, I'll just sign it off. This is Mitch Saunders, and you're listening to 91.5 FM, WMFO, Medford Tufts Freeform Radio, Swing Politics. And hope you have a great night if you're listening. Try to get some sleep. And have a good one. Signing off.
She was a hottie with a tawny, and she wore a Santa suit. She swung. said with a shout,
I'm coming down your chimney, so you better pull it out.
It's Christmas. A figgy pudding most fabulously. Oh, I was getting late when we heard such a ruckus. I dashed off to the sash just to see what the fuss is. Old Saint Nick, he was looking real boss, and there I was with Mrs. Santa Claus.
Oh, don't you worry,
she said with a wink,
go invite Kris Kringle upstairs for a drink.
He was cold and he was icy, he was covered in frost, so